I feel like I'm not doing a very good job of anything, and I don't like that.
I assume.
What's that? We have an alert.
A joke. That amendment we talked about.
Oh, perfect.
Jobs isn't quite as important.
I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is a state government conference committee meeting, and welcome to all of you that are in attendance here today and those of you that are watching on television. Members, we're going to pick up and continue our discussion on those items that there are similar language in both the House and Senate bills, but there are some significant differences. Just to recap for everyone, in our conference committee work so far, we have reviewed those items, those language items, where they are identical or nearly identical. We have passed or acted on all of those provisions, with the exception of one that we had to defer until we got some further information. We'll be going back to that later. And then we have started working our way through the language items where there are substantive differences. And members, if you look at your we have adopted language, House language on R18 dealing with the problem gambling issue. And we have then started working on general reduction language. And what we intend to do today is to work our way down this list of language. Hopefully, we will be able to resolve as much language as we can. If the language has money implications, we will have to delay action because we need to have our targets, first of all. We do not have our targets as we speak here this morning, and we have to defer that until such time as we have those targets. Once we've finished going through this list of provisions with substantive differences, then the next step would be to go to those provisions where there are no comparable provisions in either the House or the Senate bill. I don't expect that we're going to be able to get there yet today. That probably will be the reserve for the next meeting. I know the Senate, you're in session, Senator, at 10:30, is that right?
That's correct.
And so we will be recessing at 10:30 or a little bit before, and we will come back after the Senate has adjourned. You're, I understand, going to have a short meeting today, the session?
That, at this point, that's what we understand. It'll
okay.
be a short one.
And so we would be coming back into to session, and after the Senate has concluded its session. So, again, as we have done in the past, as we address language differences, we will first of all ask the staff to highlight those for us so that everybody on the conference committee is clear. And we'll let the committee ask questions. And then if there's anybody in the audience who wishes to address us relative to the language that we are considering, we will give you an opportunity to come before us and share your thoughts about that general language. So with that, members, if you would turn to page 19 on the side-by-side. And to kind of illustrate the discussion that I've already outlined here, the first section in both the House and Senate bills on page 19, starting on the Senate at 1431 through 1502, and on the House 1412 through 1417, because those get to the whole issue of our targets, we are not in a position to address that language here and now today. That's something we will have to change. But it seems to me that we could be talking about the rest of the language on that page 19. and so maybe if we could ask Mr. Shepherd if you would highlight for us the differences as you see them between the House and Senate language on the rest of that section.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I will point out some of the differences. Mr. Bodern discussed some of these last Friday, and he might want to jump in with some of those again. I won't, as you indicated, go over the dollar difference between the two because I understand that's reserved for later. One of the differences on the House side on the general reduction, you see that a MNSCU is not an executive agency for purposes of the general reduction. A little bit further down the page, there are some differences in the descriptions of the efficiencies and cost savings that can be used to achieve the general reduction, and these reflect some changes that are later in the bill. For example, Clause 4 on the House side, the consolidation of executive branch information technology systems is not on the Senate side. The Senate has a little bit broader language on the savings obtained under contracts with vendors, and there are some other, the Senate has reference to savings from benefit changes, which reflects the Senate's requirements for changing the CGIP system. There's also, Mr. Chair, a bit of the language is a little bit different with respect to savings from funds other than the general fund. And finally, I would just point out, while the House focuses on the executive branch other than MNSCU, the Senate general reduction applies to the judicial branch, and then the Senate specifies a separate specific reduction for the legislative branch. The Senate also specifies that the reductions made in 2013 are base reductions in the next biennium. Mr. Chair, with that, I ask Mr. Bodern if he had other things that would be good to add at this point.
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, the only additional thing I think I'd call your attention to is on the Senate side, beginning on line 15.13, there's some language there with a reporting requirement relating to how these changes are implemented. There's also a similar provision that actually requires a report 30 days before changes can be made to the legislative budget. That's really about all I would add.
Questions from the committee? The on 15.4, in the Senate language, says salary and benefit changes, and on the House it says salary freeze. How, Mr. Bodern or Mr. Shepherd, how would you interpret those different phrases?
Mr. Chair, I think I can point out a couple of differences. One is, as the conferees will notice later in the bill, the Senate has a requirement to change the way that the CGIP program is run. And I believe that the Senate is anticipating a lot of cost saving for executive agencies from the changes and reduced employer contributions from that program. So I think that would probably be the major component of the benefit changes. The Senate salary freeze language, if I recall back on R-53, also is a little bit different from the House language. The House doesn't address insurance at all in the salary freeze language, and the Senate, if I recall correctly, had language that says that for purposes of the salary freeze, salary doesn't include insurance as long as the employee contribution isn't decreased. So that those kinds of things may be incorporated, I think, in the difference between the House and the Senate language.
Okay, that would suggest then that for now, probably as far as we should go would be the salary freeze language. Since the health insurance issue is scheduled for the next major set of issues that we have to look at, where the Senate has something the House does not have. if the differences that trying to sort out the differences between the section starting with in the Senate 15.9 through 15.17 and then the House 14.25 through 14.29. Again, what would be the most significant differences there?
Mr. Chairman, I think the Senate language might be, the first sentence on the Senate side refers to efficiencies and cost savings that are obtained only under contracts with vendors, and then allows the transfer of those funds from non-general funds to the general fund, and specifies that that cannot occur if that those savings are realized in a fund that's established in the state constitution or protected by federal law. The House language is perhaps a little more general, and you'll see on 14.27 says that to the extent permitted by law, the commissioner is allowed to make those savings, to transfer those savings from other funds. And the House allows this to occur in any instance where there are savings in funds other than the general fund that result from reforms, efficiencies, and cost savings. So that's a little bit broader. And then, again, the Senate language would provide that these are changes to the base as well.
Further questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to these language provisions? We're talking about other than the dollar amounts here. Yes, please come forward and Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization, which is the unions at the seven state universities. I'll just speak briefly to the exclusion of MNSCU, which is in the House bill. We support the House language on that. MNSCU is taking a good deal of reductions in the higher education bill. In fiscal year 2009, I believe our appropriation that passed that year in the legislature was $689 million through unallotments, and cuts were down to $605 million a year. The House bill is $528 million. The Senate bill is $546 million. MNSCU is already doing its cuts in the higher ed bill. And they've already been very proactive in terms of doing reorganizations and reducing their costs. So that's I'll address the salary freeze when that issue comes up. But just in terms of the 15% reduction, we would prefer the House language. Thank you.
Yes, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kajewski with the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Did you want me to address the salary freeze at this time? I guess maybe I misunderstood.
Well, it's the salary freeze comes in a couple of places, but as long as you're up at the table, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I represent 13,000 professional state employees, and on behalf of AFSCME, too, who I don't see in the room, and I was prepared to speak for them on Friday when they were in another meeting, we represent about 30,000 state government employees who are in the process now of collectively bargaining our contract for the next 2 years. Mr. Chair, members, this bill really freezes our salary when you as a legislature already have the opportunity to take any action to any agreements before they take effect for any of the state employees at this time. So what both these bills essentially do is they freeze salary and they change the insurance benefits. And not to move off into the high deductible plan much, Mr. Chair, because I know you're not on that piece, what that does is take away the most substantive pieces that we get to collectively bargain and legislates that, essentially reducing any opportunity that we have to collectively bargain. 30,000 people that overwhelmingly have voted to have labor unions collectively bargain. People in all of your districts, I'm sure you've heard from many of them. In fact, I know many of you have heard from them. Mr. Chair, we think this is unnecessary. You have the opportunity with the LCC and as a full legislature to approve those contracts. There has been action in the past to change some things that have been collectively bargained, most recently under the Ventura administration when they removed domestic partner benefits from the collective bargaining agreements. Well, we see this as completely unnecessary and actually diminishing the opportunity we have as a group and as an elected group who has taken that opportunity to say that we want to collectively bargain. And although I appreciate, Mr. Chair, you've said on many occasions that, hard times call for some of these actions, we believe you have the opportunity to take whatever action you so choose through the means that are already in place rather than legislating things that actually infringe upon our rights in PELRA right now. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Any questions from committee? Yes, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As much a comment, as I went through the differences in the bills, and I start with the one that we're working on right now. I know that we've been talking about a couple of here. I want to raise the question about Minsky. I actually sat on the Higher Education Committee and have some concern about the differences in the language between the two. And just to point out that we have in R19 that in the House version there's an exclusion. And then if we go to page 56, under the 15 by 15, the Senate has an exclusion. And then if we look at 53, then we have an exclusion again. The differences in continuity regarding, and just knowing the impact that we've already had on Minsky. And then I also look at the state employee salary settlements in 10 and 11. And look at the restraint that's already been shown with Minsky employees. I would like the committee to consider the House language in these and exclude Minsky as we proceed with those three areas.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo Representative Benson's comments about Minsky. I'm not sure if members of the committee have this report showing all of the bargaining units and their settlement estimated costs for the last biennium, but it appears to me that the Minsky system has been doing some good work already. It could be discussed whether it's enough or whether this would go even further. But if I could, Mr. Chair, a question for the testifier.
Yes, Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Kujawski, first, thank you very much for coming and talking to me about some of the provisions that I have in here, and hopefully we'll have a chance to keep working together. A question for you regarding a wage freeze. When I look at the settlements from the last biennium, you represent MAPE, and they had a 2.18% overall increase biennium to biennium, and I assume that's kind of the total cost of the entire settlement. Are we contemplating in our collective bargaining discussions, you said that they're ongoing, are we contemplating actual cuts this year, and would a freeze perhaps bind us to a scenario, would the language here bind us to a scenario where we couldn't cut if that were what was collectively bargained?
Mr. Kujawski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. Let me see if I can get all of your questions here.
There were two.
First of all, I'm not part of the collective bargaining team, and to say that I'm privy to expose what strategies we have to collectively bargain would be dishonest. But Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, We have not even met across the table with the state yet. Those dates are on the calendar and upcoming rather soon. I don't know the exact date, but I believe it might even be this month yet. So I think that's the first part of your question. The second part of your question is, if I understand right, can you actually legislate a reduction with this language? And I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that this language requires a freeze, not a reduction. I think that would probably prevent that. Can there be, can a reduction actually be negotiated? Most certainly. But I don't think that this language permits it.
Mr. Chair. Donnie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kajewski, thank you. One final question. I'm somewhat new at this, and I remember last term we got the collective bargaining agreements pretty late in the second year of the legislative session, if I remember right, and we were, I'm pretty confident we got it in the second year of the biennium as compared to the first, and so we were largely approving kind of compensation in arrears. Is there any chance this year that it would go faster, that we'd actually be able to deal with this really important budgetary matter as a legislature kind of during this process or in the first year of the biennium as compared to the second, or are we always going to be faced with this with the legislature approving something in the rearview mirror?
Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Downey, what generally happens is we negotiate a contract prior to the end of the expiration of the previous contract, which would be June 30th of this year. So historically, you are already adjourned for the year, and our contract historically has run past that time, and that's why there's a provision in statute that actually extends our contract out if we're still collectively bargaining the contract. Last year was one of a few times when we have actually reached a settlement prior to the end of the biennium. And the process actually at times in the legislatures has slowed down to wait for other collective bargaining agreements to settle and catch up. So even in the second year of the legislative biennium, it ends up at the very end of the legislative session because there still are contracts that are outstanding that they're waiting before they put them all into one bill and pass them. So, Representative Downey, there is an opportunity to settle it rather quick. I don't think that the dates in the calendar right now, the way it's set up, would expedite it to the extent that it was the last contract. But that opportunity always exists with the state of Minnesota, and sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. We normally schedule a push week where everybody's kind of cooped up in a hotel and works through the night, you know, all week to get this done. And sometimes it still doesn't get done, and they end up scheduling another week, and we're kind of at the mercy of the mediator at that point, too. So they can call for a break and do all kinds of other things that really aren't necessarily in our power to change.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you. Just good confirmation of my recollection. Just an observation, and I don't know if we're going to agree on the language here and not the numbers, but Mr. Kajewski raises some interesting points to think about. If, in fact, we just left the process as is, the legislature could look backward a year from now or 9 months from now at the beginning of the session and reject the negotiated contracts and impose cuts at that point to balance the budget, knowing what the gap would be and having the benefit of hindsight in terms of what our revenues were and our expenses were, and we could retroactively do all of this and actually cut severely if we needed to in these labor agreements. And in some ways, the position that we've got in our respective bills is probably a softer provision. So anyway, just an observation as we go through our deliberations here that mandating a freeze at the beginning of the process might in fact be the most generous option available to us. So just a thought.
Representative Stensrud.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just a clarifying question on the Senate language on 15.4, when they leave it to get savings under 15.4 through salary and benefit changes compared to the House language where it refers to salary freeze. Does that give us a little more, the Senate language give us a little broader? If there are negotiations with the bargaining unit, with Mr. Kajewski mentioned, if there is a reduction, would our House language preclude those savings, and would it be more accommodating on the Senate language? Is
Mr. Shepherd, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, a couple of thoughts, and then Mr. Bodden may have some additional thoughts on the Senate language. First of all, these in both the House and the Senate side, there's a required budget reduction. On the House side, for example, MMB must reduce appropriations by $94.9 million. Well, these other things listed on the House side in clauses 1 through 6 are tools to achieve that, but they're not limiting. So the fact that the House language isn't as broad as the Senate language would not preclude the use of those tools. This is the House just saying to the greatest extent possible that the savings would come from these type of tools, but they could come from other. I think the, as Mr. Bodden has mentioned in the past, on the Senate side, the benefit changes are at least in part a result of language in the Senate bill that the committee will be discussing later on page R55, which actually establishes new terms for the State Employee Group Insurance Program. It has required employer deposits to individual health savings accounts and high deductible health plan. And so that, I think, may be why the Senate referenced the benefit changes there, because they have specific language that sets out what those changes will be.
Mr. Bodden.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with everything Mr. Shepherd said, and I just point out that what you see listed in the clauses here, 1 through 6 on the House side and 1 through 5 on the Senate side, these are basically cross-references. They're not intended to have a substantive effect on their own.
Mr. Shepherd, in the Senate language 1518 through 1521, we don't have comparable language, at least in this section, in the House. Do we have it somewhere else in the House bill, something like that?
Mr. Chair, I believe not. And again, I defer to Senate staff, Mr. Bodden or Lundeen, on this, but I believe that this language may represent the Senate's estimate of savings to the legislature from implement of the high-deductible health plan in the CGIP program. And so that is why we don't have anything parallel in the House, because we don't have a parallel change in the insurance program.
Mr. Bodden, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so, in essence, then, this should probably be on the list of no comparables of things that we need to come back to here. further question from Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for counsel. As you look at the House language, it excludes Minsky early on here, R19. And it does not exclude the Senate, or in the Senate bill, Minsky is not excluded. But it is, if you look, Minsky is excluded if you look on page R56. So just if counsel could just briefly touch base on those differences in the impact in the bill.
Mr. Bodden.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Daley, yes, you're correct that Minsky is excluded on the Senate side with respect to the operation of the what's known as 15 by 15. So basically that would prevent using that as a tool to obtain the number shown for reduction on the Senate side. I think the key difference would be if the savings that are required here are not achieved through the use of the tools that are specified here, the language on each side gives the Commissioner of Management and Budget the authority to allocate further appropriate reductions in order to accomplish that target. The difference would be that on the House side, those additional reductions could not be allocated to Minsky. On the Senate side, they could. And again, those are operating budget reductions.
Further question from committee members. Members, it's been suggested to me that maybe one way in which we can go at this is to ask our respective counsel here to prepare an amendment, since we have some slight differences here, taking a look at lines 15.3 in the Senate through 15.17 and lines 14.18 through 14.29 in the House. If you're so inclined, we could ask our counsel to work out the technical differences there and come back to us with some language that we might consider. Does that sound like a reasonable approach? Mr. Botter and Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, yes. I do think we can do that on the technical level. As the discussion has occurred today, it is become apparent that a lot of these language differences are tied to very major substantive differences
right.
between the bills, and so we could sort of point those out and kind of suggest language that if you decided to implement the Senate position, you would then accept certain language from the Senate side here, same with the House position. But there's some major policy decisions that you have to make that Mr. Bodden and I can't resolve.
But Mr. Shepherd, I think whatever the target appears to be, it strikes me that we're going to need some language here that gives flexibility to deal with whatever the target might be. And these sections do not really necessarily prescribe what it is we're going to do. Rather, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. And I think Mr. Bodden and I can help by working out some of the technical details, so it'll be easier for you when you make the substantive decisions.
Okay. Further thoughts from the committee? Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other observation for staff. I think the must on line 14.27 in the House language may also imply a substantive difference to the may on line 15.11 in the Senate language. So that might be something else. It seems like maybe the House was prescribing the transfer and the Senate was allowing it. That could also be a substantive difference just as a to locate the issue, not to enter into discussion on it necessarily.
If it's okay, then we will ask Mr. Shepherd, Mr. Bodden to confer and come back with some language that hopefully works out the technical differences there are between these sections and help clarify all of this. Is that acceptable? Okay, that's what we will do, and let's see, is Representative Banyan here yet? He's not. He's Representative Banyan, who was the House author for the zero-based budgeting, will be here in a little while, and so we're going to delay on that. Commissioner Showalter, did you wish to address us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. Appreciate the chance to be back. And I want to just address several issues regarding the language that you're going through right now.
Okay.
Putting aside the level of reductions that are discussed here, a couple of points. One is that this is really looking at the input side of the budget, and I would just again offer commissioners are available to help explain some of the output and performance issues that go with that, because the numbers side doesn't tell the whole story. How do you get to this level of impact? Two, I would like to just remind everyone about the nature of state spending. As shown here on 15.6, it's talking about operational efficiencies and cost savings due to contractors and vendors. Most of the state budget is not directly delivered by state agencies. About 25 to 30% of the state budget is from healthcare services that are sent out to other providers. About 10% to local units of government, another 10% to higher education institutions, and another about 40% going to higher education, K-12 institutions. So most of the state budget isn't directly pertaining to that language regarding contracts with vendors, or at least that's not my interpretation, so that we're really narrowing in on about a 4% operational cost that is up and above the additional 4 to 5% of direct compensation costs that we're looking at here. So I just so members have a concrete understanding of just the scope of what this is dealing with. The numbers are large, but the actual areas of the state budget that it pertains to are relatively narrow. As we briefly discussed on Friday before going into other topics, the timing of this is going to be something you should discuss and consider. That the time necessary to put together the changes, whether they're in the contracts, whether with vendors, or to find out what savings are actually there, what efficiencies are actually there, the timing of then coming back and using whatever allocation method is envisioned here is likely to be well into the budget biennium, so that the impact and the swiftness of change that will be necessary is significant. So as you think through the implementation of that, I would commend that to you as well, that while it seems likely or hopeful that we would identify all the efficiencies come July 1, that is, I think, supposed to be the demonstrated efficiencies, the demonstrated impacts here. That will take a while. Third, looking at 15.4, 14.1 on the House side, 15.5 and 14.20, again, on the House side, the workforce challenges that we have right now. Representative Downey correctly was the other day looking at a wonderful report. I just was impressed that it was in circulation about our workforce and some of the challenges that we have. I don't see that the language that enters into the collective bargaining process to mandate certain things or suggest certain things, or the elimination of some of the senior management helps the underlying problem, which is that state government has a salary cap right now, is basically at a competitive disadvantage compared to state colleges, universities, the University of Minnesota, local units of government. And I know the budget pressures. I'm not arguing for that change necessary as much as to say this is probably taking us in the wrong direction as being a farm team for lots of other organizations. And so if you're looking for ways to improve the efficiency and performance, usually that means having some management talent around. And I'm not sure that this gets you there. So those are a few of those considerations. We'd be happy to elaborate if you would like, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, if I understand what you were just saying, are you telling us that the difficulty we have in recruiting top talent because of limitations on compensation for state government, that having these titles would help?
Mr. Chair, these titles don't quite get us there. They certainly help in recruiting. Assistant commissioners, deputy commissioners, it certainly helps in the recruitment process. But I think if you look through the years, where do those people go after they've been done with that? They will go to other sectors of the public sector. They will go to other entities around the Capitol. They will go almost everywhere but stay in state government, so that the experience and understanding of the process that we might want to have oftentimes leaves the process. So I would just look at the Compensation Council reports of a number of years. I would look at the workforce report. We have a significant workforce issue. And that is only one of many, many issues. And I think just looking at the input side probably won't get us where we're looking to go as a state. We need a trained, respected, competent workforce. I think we've got some of those things, but we need to develop that for a lot of the challenges looking ahead, a lot of the reforms that you're trying to get done. I would just hope that you would think about this as a workforce policy as well as just an input dollars and cents policy.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe some of these questions have more to do with the freeze and the workforce reduction on R56. And if you'd prefer, I can certainly hold my questions. But I think Mr. Showalter raises some really good points, and it would be good to have some discussion on them. So if you'd like, I can wait until we get to those sections, or if he's here and we're talking about it, I'm glad to go now, so I'll defer to you if you'd prefer that I wait.
Well, the freeze, we're going to be talking about that in a little bit again, so because it's in different parts of the bill, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Showalter, you raised really good points, and I know we worked hard to try and design our workforce reduction and wage freeze provisions so that they kind of worked together and attempted to address, I think, what everybody recognizes is a demographic in our state workforce that's a real problem, irrespective of our budget issues, just in terms of balancing the workforce. So we're trying to take all three of those things, the cost, the size, and the balance, so that we would have a really sustainable and well-structured workforce. And we attempted to provide flexibility to the executive branch so that we didn't over-prescribe exactly how and where and when to do all of these things, and yet at the same time setting some targets to make sure that we did get there. So I'm curious about a couple of comments you made. My observation, just in looking at the workforce data, and I think we've heard the same thing, I don't know if it's from MAPE or AFSCME and some of their reports and recommendations, is that we're actually top-heavy in terms of management and supervisory levels, and a lot of that has to do with the kind of aging demographic and the seniority of the people. So can you comment on that in terms of if we need good management-level talent, is it hanging on to what we have, or is it developing the few younger people that are in, I shouldn't say the few, but relatively speaking, comparatively speaking, the fewer number? Where are you coming at in terms of this need to retain management and supervisory talent when it seems like maybe we're top-heavy and have too much of that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wouldn't necessarily call it a top-heavy situation, but I do think that there's a set of skills and experiences that are necessary for quality management, and the incentives aren't always so well aligned. Sometimes having the expertise rather than the management is what we're trying to retain. I would also just say that the turnover due to the demographics will be significant. So I think it's an and situation. It's making sure we are able to compete and keep some of the more experienced managers as necessary in an agency, as well as develop those and be able to recruit from the outside. In the last year, I've had the opportunity, I guess we should say, to recruit assistant commissioners into the agency, and it is a difficult task to get people who I think can handle the very difficult, very broad responsibilities that we put on them, and I think that is going to be a challenge.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I actually agree with you, Mr. Showalter, on that point. In terms of some of my previous work in state government, this is a big organization, and running a $60 billion organization, which is made up of whatever, 10 to 15 very large sub-organizations and another whatever 50 or 60 smaller ones, that's not easy. And so I actually agree with you. And the Taxpayers Association report that came out comparing by position, not just educational attainment and years experience, but comparing by position in state government to the private sector, showed that about 72% of our positions are overcompensated in state government, and those happen to be, I'll, with no disrespect to anybody, say it's the entry level, the lower level positions, routine tasks, repetitive functions. That 10% or 18% of our state employees are undercompensated. And guess what? It's the highly technical, it's the attorneys, it's the IT, the engineering, it's the more skilled folks, it's the higher level management people such as you described. And then about 10% were more or less the same in the public sector versus the private sector. And I actually had a provision in a bill that would have conducted a wage study that would have compared public and private sector, and it would have tried to equalize them so that we could offer higher compensation to those more highly skilled specialized functions, the rare commodities, and be competitive there, and yet fairly pay but not overpay at the other levels. And I think there was quite a bit of testimony against that, largely from the standpoint that we'd be superseding collective bargaining. So I'm curious whether or not you would support an increased flexibility or an opportunity to do what my bill actually prescribed, which was let's right-size compensation at the various levels in state government so you are competitive in the places that you need to be and you do have the talent you need, and let's not overcompensate at the others. I mean, would you, I don't know, you personally, or would the administration support such a move as that, or no, it violates collective bargaining, and so we can't really go there?
Commissioner?
And Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with Representative Downey. That's something we need to look into, find ways. I'm not, as an individual or as a commissioner, interested in a quid pro quo of trading off one group versus another and trying to tie those two explicitly. I think as a governing body, the legislature and the executive branch need to look at ways to make sure that we have a competent and successful workforce in order to do the work of a very large enterprise. So I would be happy to talk more offline about that provision that I'm not quite familiar with. The bottom line here is that the language that you have before you goes the other direction, that it basically does, I think we get the message in terms of instructions on collective bargaining and what the legislature is interested in. But it doesn't give us much flexibility in trying to structure those provisions through the collective bargaining process. And it also seems to be, again, narrowing the scope of management responsibilities, either at the commissioner level or assistant commissioner level or those below, because we're basically taking some of those instructions and saying we will do those centrally and then just make resource reductions, whether through the salary and compensation pool or through the specific tools and other organizational changes that will have to happen in order to achieve the savings. So I'm just saying we're going in the other way right now, and I appreciate the representative's interest in looking at this.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, and then we can move on. But my observation is that we have worked very hard to try and structure what we've got in our bill in a really intelligent and strategic way, and we haven't bound the hands of the governor. To the extent that we've set some broad parameters and put up some guardrails and set some targets that we think are absolutely imperative to put state government on a structurally sustainable, sound footing for the future with regard to our workforce, which is a component of that. I think we've got just the right balance, and I would disagree with the commissioner's statement that we're going in the wrong direction. I think with the absence of this, with the exception of the fact that this provision of right-sizing compensation at the position level isn't in here, I think we've done a pretty good job, and we've allowed some discretion and flexibility at the executive branch level to do it in a way that gets us there as best as we can and with as good an outcome for our employees as we can. And I think to represent our bills as a really kind of hard rush to the wrong direction, I don't think that's a fair interpretation. It certainly isn't an interpretation of intent.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, one perspective that I think might be useful is just where the state employees are. And some of the changes here are irregardless of the funding source or the activities that are being handled. So, you know, our ability to reduce 15% of our snowplow drivers when we've already got one person on the snowplow, our ability to change the correctional institutions when we've invested in the infrastructure to minimize the staffing levels. Things like that are where those agencies are some of the major employers of the state right now. I would encourage you to think about the unintended consequences of the broad parameters that are here. I'm getting towards the level issue again, Mr. Chair, but that is one of the issues.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in the interest of finding some common ground so that we can resolve the opportunity, the challenge, the budget that we're trying to work on, the governor had stated that he's looking for a 6% workforce reduction. We're talking about, and that's over the biennium, over 2 years. We're looking at 15% over 4 years. So if you were to cut that in half, that's 7.5%, let's say, just for argument's sake. It's pretty close in this current biennium, 6%, 7.5%. Again, in the interest of finding common ground, maybe we can talk about that as a start point What were some of the things that some of the, if you were to put that into a spreadsheet like this, what does that 6% look like? How does it compare? And maybe we can start a conversation to closing the gap.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the 6% are where the FTEs are impacted in the governor's budget. That figure is a general fund impact. And so that information is on each and every one of the pages in the budget documents that were presented. I don't have a summary of the governor's FTE impact to compare directly, but that's certainly accessible and doable. You're going to see impacts in part because of some of the assumptions that operating budgets aren't going to go up and that agencies are going to have to manage within their resources in a broad set of ways. So you're going to see some attrition. You're going to see some elimination of positions in some areas where the instructions that are in front of us are is that it also goes to federal funds. It goes to dedicated, constitutionally dedicated funds. It goes to special revenue funds. A lot of other activities that were not impacted in the governor's recommendations. So there's both this a magnitude issue and also just the breadth that you would see the differences if I had a table for you right now.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think it's worth looking at some of the details so that we can proceed, so that we can find out some more of the details of exactly where the governor is with that. We can see where we are, and we can have a real discussion so we can close that gap.
Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the point that Senator Daley was trying to make, Mr. Showalter, on the bottom of your the chart with the governor's proposed interpretations of our bills and his original budget, it actually shows the total executive branch reduction of 17 individuals and then a total of all branches increase of 22 individuals. And I'm wondering, is the 6% reduction proposed by the governor not reflected in your chart?
Commissioner?
That doesn't seem like 6% or anywhere even close. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't have row numbers, but the total for the executive branch general is an increase of 4 people. The total of the executive constitutional branches is a net negative of 17. The judicial branch is an increase of 35, and then the net is a total increase of 22, which doesn't seem like a 6% reduction. I don't know, maybe you didn't factor the 6% reduction into this spreadsheet like you did in the columns for the House and Senate bills. And if you just need to get back to me and explain, that would be fine, too.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've been informed that reflects the base budget and not the governor's rec. So as you suspected, that is looking at base changes. So we should clarify that.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I'll stay very far away of our conversation on Friday, but the title of the column says 2012 and 13 governor's changes, so I'm not, if that's relative to base, and then there's a net. So anyway, so some clarification, because that column heading seems to be equally confusing as the other ones that we talked about on Friday. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
we will certainly try to clarify what those numbers represent and get you follow-up information on the governor's impacts. I just want to point out that the governor's recommendations were detailed at an agency-by-agency level, and you know where we're talking about the allocation or what's covered by the language before you. Right now, the language is very, very broad. You know, there have been opportunities to narrow that, and I think the legislature's intentionally left broad flexibility for the executive branch to reduce budgets and FTE counts in most, if not nearly all, executive branch agencies. And so to the point of yesterday, this is still a very broad set of lists. And in comparing the governor's recommendations, those are specific agency by agency. Unless you would like me to make more assumptions, I will be comparing it just to the sort of simple pro rata comparison.
Any other questions of the commissioner? Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you just get me started every time you make that statement. We have allowed broad implementation. And every time you make that statement, you make me feel like you don't want to do your job, and the commissioners don't want to do their job. And again, I said it Friday, if we have to micromanage, then why do we need commissioners? And if you're unsure, then give us specific questions that you're unsure about. I mean, it doesn't make sense that in one essence you want the flexibility to do your jobs, but in the next sense you don't want to be the bad guy or gal if you have to make some serious cuts. You can't have it both. You just can't. And so every time you make the statement, Commissioner, you start getting me riled, because I think, why are we spending $100,000+ a year, whatever the compensation is for our commissioners, if they can't do the job?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think the people who are trying to lead state agencies very explicitly said, yes, I want to try to do the job. They are trying to take on a broad set of uncertainties and challenges and provide leadership. The level of the cuts that you're talking about and the mission and the mandates and the expectations that are out there are what I immediately want to bring to your attention. And the question of what resources should be available to an agency are being addressed in other omnibus bills. The expectations and the good works that are expected out of those appropriations are set. And over here, we will end up taking out significant resources so that their ability to get there is compromised. And that's why you have commissioners in the audience to help you understand both pieces. Because right now, the legislature has appropriation levels in one hand and an uncertain distribution that Commissioner of MMB is to make on the other hand. We're looking for some clarity and expectations and a common understanding of what the impacts of these resource levels are.
Commissioner, I want to thank you for giving us today some constructive suggestions on language. That's the way this process ought to work. We need you and your colleagues who are commissioners, agency heads, to let us know if you have particular concerns about language or the way something might work. That should be a part of our process here in conference committee, to fix those kinds of things. We are not here to negotiate the overall targets. The governor and the leadership of the House and the Senate are doing that. And but I think it's very important that we have this kind of discussion here in conference committee, so that at such time we do have, and hopefully we will have, an agreement between our leadership and the governor as to overall where we're headed. We will have at least been able to work out the differences in language to expedite the resolution of this budget. And so I wanted to say the discussion we've had this morning has been far more constructive than I think the discussion we had on previously, where you and others were, in effect, trying to negotiate for the governor. And Let's get to the business here of trying to work out some language that hopefully will pave the way towards a resolution of our budget. Members of Commissioner France, did you wish to speak?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I would like to join Commissioner Showalter and members of the committee. Myron France, Commissioner of Revenue. I thought the discussion changed a little bit here, that it might be appropriate to come up and talk about a couple of specifics, because I understand the concern about how we really deal with the language of the bill and where we put those cuts. One of the concerns we have for the revenue department is some of the allocated cuts to the department. Now, I know we've been having discussions about the unallocated portion, but I'd like to just briefly this morning mention some concerns that we have at the revenue department about cuts to the Department of Revenue that are allocated. I think in the Senate bill, the allocations would amount to our estimation of between around $67 million in revenue losses, and the Senate bill would be $67 million in losses, and the House bill would be $111 million in revenue losses. Now, the reason for that is that we believe we've come to a point where we simply cannot cut staff without having some effect on the ability to collect revenue. As you know, the Department of Revenue for the years has been very involved in working with this committee in tax compliance initiatives over the years. I think since 2002, the compliance initiatives have changed so much that I think at one point we were raising about $250 million a year in direct compliance activities, and now it's about $650 million a year. So I think the revenue department has done what the legislature has asked it to do over the years to help in these direct compliance activities to generate more money for compliance. Now, obviously, the bulk of what the department does, though, is in the voluntary compliance area. As we all know, I think it's $16.2 billion a year comes in through the voluntary compliance program. Now, over the years, since 1996, we used to have 593 employees on the support side of the revenue department, and now we're down to about 234 employees on the compliance, the support side for the Department of Revenue. And that's the good news. I mean, I think part of what, and I want to give total credit to the prior commissioners. Commissioner Salamone, when he was commissioner, was involved with this committee to help with compliance initiatives, to reduce the number of people working on support. Commissioner Innes, likewise, followed up on that. So the prior commissioners deserve credit for getting to where we are. But we believe that we're getting to a point now that cuts are going to have revenue effects. I know that the language is to try to take the cuts out of the support part of the compliance support part of the budget. And certainly we can try to do that, but we believe that we've gotten to a point now that cuts of this nature, 9% or 15%, allocated cuts are going to have a direct effect on our ability to manage the voluntary compliance system. As we all know, most people in Minnesota pay their taxes, and they try to pay them as accurately as they can. Some people don't, and that's why we have the direct compliance initiatives to encourage people to pay their fair share. But it's our belief at this juncture, Mr. Chair, that further cuts in the Department of Revenue of this magnitude will have revenue effects. I was reading just the other day, California cut up some revenue agents and some revenue people in their Department of Revenue, and they believe they've lost $7 for every dollar they've cut in the revenue department. Arizona cut $25 million in their budget for the revenue department and lost $100 million in revenue. Clearly, we have to be careful, and I don't want to suggest that the Department of Revenue shouldn't take its fair share of trying to get smarter, better, more efficient. We're clearly on board with that. And once again, kind of referring back to previous administrations, we're in phase three of a four-phase integrated tax system that I think are going to pay real dividends going down the line when we talk later on this morning maybe about data analytics and other tools. So the department is completely on board. But I want right now, Mr. Chair, as we're talking about the interaction of these numbers, we're concerned that the cuts that are proposed, the allocated cuts that are proposed for the Department of Revenue, are going to have revenue losses that we're going to have to deal with as part of the overall budget. And that's why I wanted to jump in at this point, because that's where we have real numbers and real concerns, Mr. Chair.
Well, Commissioner, we appreciate your being here and your comments. I want to stay focused on the language that we're trying to work our way through. We're not talking money here today. We're talking language, realizing that language can affect money. To the extent that it's directly tied, we're going to set it aside, as we've already done. We've talked about section 1431 through 15.2 and 1412 through 1417. We've set it aside. We need to come back to that and have the kind of discussion that you're pointing to here. So, members, I want to stay focused on the language so we can get through and hopefully make more progress. Again, I would ask the committee if you're still okay with our instructing our legal staff here to work out the language on this section and bring it back to us. Okay, that's what we will do, and we're going to move now to pages 38 through 40, the zero-based budgeting, and Mr. Shepherd, would you, thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Shepherd, would you start us working our way through the differences here on the language?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members, the House and Senate positions on the zero-based budgeting and performance data are quite similar in most respects, so I will just point out the differences that I have observed, and then Mr. Bodern can point out any other differences that he sees. The first one, Mr. Chair, that I would call your attention to is on page R39. On the House side, line 33.3, the House, this is a reference to stating what the base is for expenditure projections for the next biennium, and the concepts are similar on the House and Senate side. The House adds language recognizing sort of a technical change that in some cases there may be another law that sets the base at a different level than the amount appropriated in the second year of the current biennium. So the House just added that technical language, and I think that's the only difference there. On page R40, Mr. Chair, there's a small technical difference on line 30.31 on the Senate side. The Senate has the correct section reference there, section 16A.641. The House has an incorrect reference, so whichever side we work off of, we should use the Senate reference there. The next difference that I was going to point out, it occurs in several places throughout, but I'll just describe the concept. Under the Senate bill, the principles of zero-based budgeting would apply to half of the agents, half of the programs each biennium. The House changed its bill during the process so that once the zero-based program is phased in, it will apply to all the agencies every biennium. And that difference is reflected in several places through here, but once the conferees decide on the concept, the language to implement it would follow. You could either take all of the Senate language on that or all of the House language. Mr. Chair, the next substantive item I would like to call your attention to is on page R40. It's the language on the House side in the block of 33.11 to 33.16, clause 2 there. The House has several differences. The concept is all the same here, but these were added in House committee, and it is further specification of the three alternative funding levels that would be produced as part of the zero-based budgeting principles. On House side, 33.12 and 33.13, the House language requires that at least one of the alternative levels has to be less than the previous biennium's actual expenditures for that budget activities. On line 33.14, Mr. Chair, the House adds language indicating that the comparison of the increments of value that would be added would in part be compared to a zero budget on line 33.14. And then on 33.15 and 33.16, the House has another block of language asking that the comparison, again, be based on what would be accomplished if there were no funding for the activity at all. Mr. Chair, there's another technical change on the Senate side, page R41, line 31.17. The Senate has a reference to a paragraph there. That's the correct reference, and so whichever substantive choices the committee makes, we should use the Senate language on that. The other differences, which you see on R41, are all related to the concept of whether the zero-based budgeting would apply to all agencies, as on the House side once phased in, or whether you would choose the Senate position of having zero-based apply to half of the programs each biennium. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask Mr. Bodern if he sees other things we should point out on this issue.
Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Shepard covered everything.
Mr. Shepard, back on page 40, the Senate language 3013 through 3030, we don't have comparable language, correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and the House bill used to have this language. This language refers, it leads in each biennium the proposed budget for approximately one half of the expenditure programs. So this is part of that substantive difference between the House and the Senate, where they have in permanent law that only one half of the programs would use zero-based budgeting. If you look on page R41, this is on the House lines 33.34 to 34.8. This is roughly this. It's the same concept on the House side, but it instead of being expressed in permanent law as half of the programs every biennium, it's phased in once. And then after that, all of the programs under the House proposal would be using ZBB after it's phased in. So that's why there's no comparable House language to the Senate on R40 and no comparable Senate language on R41. But it's related to that concept of the phase-in.
Questions from the committee? I believe Representative Banyan is here. You want to come up to the testifiers table there, Representative Banyan, and if you have some advice for us in terms of the differences that you see between the House and Senate language.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Representative King Banyan from St. Cloud. Thank you, all of you, for hearing about zero-based budgeting. I know I had the pleasure of speaking before the Senate as well as the House Senate Committee, as well as the House Committee on this issue, and I appreciate the chance to explain it to you. At the time when we presented House File 2 and Senate File, from memory, 174, this was a bill that was in the form that's currently in the Senate version. I believe what happened was we simply had presented Senate File 174, and I believe it was adopted pretty much word for word. As you will know, Chair Lanning, when we went into the House version, we made some tweaks and changes to it. So the language on zero-based budgeting in the House file is an update. And the reason for that update was a conversation that was relayed to me from our fiscal analyst in the House, Ms. Roberts, and from other staff that MMB felt that the switching back and forth that I had originally envisioned in the Senate that is in the Senate version would be more time consuming for them than to simply put them into zero-based budgeting once and for all. That is something that you may still wish to discuss with them as to whether they think that is still true as you go forward in your negotiations. But the feeling was once they were in zero-based budgeting, they may as well just simply stay in that process and move forward from there. The House version allows them to do that. The Senate version didn't get caught up to that request made by MMB. And I apologize to Senator Chamberlain and to Senator Perry as well, Chair Perry as well, for not getting that over to you, because we might have been able to avoid this little conversation here. But otherwise, I think you will see that the substantive differences within the two versions you have turn on that single question, And you know, in respect to, we need this to be something that really works with the executive branch, something they're comfortable doing. On that basis, I'm going to ask that you would accept the House version as being more in line with what seems to be agreed to among the parties.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Banyan, thank you. I know we moved the bill quickly and didn't have a chance to go through all this. So with that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I would, with help from counsel, I would move that we proceed with House language.
Senator Perry moves the House language on the zero-based budgeting section, which is pages 38 to 40. There were a couple of technical things that would need to be fixed, correct, Mr. Bodden and Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chairman, just a very quick amendment to that language before you adopt it. I think we'll take care of it.
Okay.
So on the House side, on R40, on line 33.32, delete 16A.642 and insert...
Say the line again, please.
Sorry, 33.32.
Okay.
You would delete 16A.642 and insert 16A.641. And then on R41 on the House side, on line 33.26, after in, insert paragraph A, comma.
You incorporate that, Senator Perry?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shepard, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, I do, yes.
Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard with regard to this section of the language? Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to just clarify exactly what pages and lines the committee would discuss in this motion?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that you would be discussing, beginning on page R38 on the House side, line 31.25, and all of R39, R39, and all of R40 as amended by Mr. Bodden's suggestion, and then all of R41, and then R42 on the House side down to line 35.32.
The ending point.
35.2, excuse me.
Say that again, where we end.
Mr. Chair, page R42, 35.2.
Okay, everybody clear on that? If so, all in favor of that language being adopted, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. That section is adopted. Thank you, Representative Banyan. We will now move to pages 50, 59, and 60, the Federal Offset Program. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the first block of language is on the top of page R50. And the difference here is that the House has some language that would provide that an agreement for offset under the section must not allow for offset of payments if the debt is being contested or if the time for appealing it has not yet expired. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, and I haven't had a chance to discuss this with any of the Senate staff or others, but that at some point last week there was some discussion of potential changes to this House position on this. And
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, that was expressed in, I think at some point, it's my understanding that the House would wanted to discuss an amendment that would clarify that the United States Department of Treasury would charge a fee to cover its costs of operating the program, and that the state could add the fee to the balance being processed, and that the Treasury offset program agreement that the state would enter into would not require federal agencies to provide different due process than what is set forth in current federal regulations. The concept that was being discussed also would, in place of what is on paragraph D on R50 of the current House language, 42.31 to 42.33, the new language would specify that a debt is eligible for offset. It would specify conditions under which the debt would be eligible for offset. It would include that reasonable attempts would have been made to collect the debt. It's greater than 6 months old, less than 10 years old. The debtor is not in bankruptcy. Notice is sent in a certified letter at least 60 days prior to filing an offset claim, and that the debtor would then have 60 days to contest the offset. So that was, I'm not certain of the status of that language, Mr. Chair, but this was a language that I understand had been under discussion.
Mr. Bodden?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't had an opportunity to review that language, and I don't know if Mr. Shepherd is going to address this, but there is additional language that's tied into this on R60 on the Senate side. This is for offsetting state payments against federal non-tax obligations, and again would authorize an agreement with the Department of the Treasury, U.S. Department of the Treasury. This is additional language that was requested by the Senate side. See that lines 41.4 through 41.25.
That's language that we don't have in the House, correct?
Yes, that, Mr. Chair, that is correct. There was testimony when the Department of Revenue discussed this provision in the House. They had mentioned the concept that they thought it would be helpful to add this type of language in Chapter 270C.41. I think the Senate probably acted on this concept a bit later, and they had worked with the Senate and did add the language that they had mentioned and suggested to the House.
Questions from the committee? Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner Steen Block is with me. Myron Franz, again, Commissioner of Revenue. We just want to be available about any language issues. We have been discussing this issue with the Department of Treasury. As the committee knows and council knows, those agreements are quite specific, and we have some concerns about the language. We want to make sure that some of the changes are made. We've presented some language suggestions earlier, and we're happy to work with the committee on making sure the technical aspects are complied with. I don't know if you want to add anything, Assistant Commissioner Steve Block.
I think you covered it. I'll answer anything.
Just want to be available if that's something we could do.
Well, if you want to outline your language concerns, we'd be happy to hear it.
Mr. Chair, please
identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes for the Department of Revenue. There's a few things with the way the language stands right now. One of the things that you will note is that the language is listed under 16D on the House side. 16D allows us to utilize this tool for the collection of other state agency debts, but only limiting it to 16D does not allow us to use this tool on the tax side as well. And our assumption is you would probably want to use this for both the reciprocal agreement for both tax and non-tax debts. So we did provide some additional language in a couple different areas. 16D, as it stands right now, we had provided some language that allowed that to be consistent on both the House and the Senate side and be consistent with other reciprocal agreements that we currently have in place right now with the Treasury or in the Internal Revenue Service. We had recommended 270C.41, and that is one that has been adopted on the Senate side. And that just allows basically for the way that language is written now, it talks about the IRS. The reciprocal agreement that you want to put into place would be handled through the Treasury, So making that change to that language to state federal government allows for both the IRS and the Treasury if we make the change to the federal government. And there was one component that we had recommended that is missing, which is 270C.545, which allows the fees for federal payments. And that's cleaning up language there that is currently in place for the federal offset, and it allows us to use the similar language and cleans up that fee structure for both reciprocal and the federal piece.
Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I am tracking kind of what we're talking about in the respective documents. So just to kind of go in no particular order. So the 270C.41 discussion that you're having is actually 41.1. On page R60, it's 41.13, that subdivision in the Senate bill. So that's already in the Senate position.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other two, you mentioned 16D and then 270C.545. Are those just comments, or are those what is dealt with in the amendment that we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, those were in reference to the language that we have provided in previous testimony that would help streamline the program and make it more effective and efficient for both tax and non-tax, and for existing programs to align with existing programs.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, and then for staff. So is what she's describing actually what's included in our A31 amendment, or are we dealing with another set of amendments in the A31 as well as the suggestions from the testimony?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, the A31 does not represent the suggestions from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just one for either of the two testifiers. So all of the changes, the one that's in the Senate language and the two others that you're recommending, it sounded to me from what you described, and I don't know operationally how all this works behind the doors over there, is what you just described and proposed, if I'm reading it right, would actually open up our opportunities as compared to constrict them?
Ms. Steinblatt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, that is correct.
Thank you.
Do you have a position on this A31 amendment? Have you had an opportunity to look at that?
Mr. Chair, members, we do have some positions. We do have some concerns with the A1 amendment.
The A1?
Or the amendment that's in front of you.
It's A31.
Sorry, A31.
A31?
Yes.
Okay. It would be helpful to me if you could, I want to be sure I'm clear as to what language sections you are okay with and where you've got some concerns. I'm not real clear on that from our discussion so far. I would find that helpful if you could mark up side by side or whatever and let us know where there is agreement or concern.
We can do that, Chair. We'd be glad to, Mr. Chair, put that together for this committee. I think it's important to just as a department to make it clear that the federal offset program is something that the department's been doing since 2003, and this expansion is something that makes sense, and it's part of where we agree with the committee. We can discuss, obviously, the fiscal note about this at some other point when you want to talk about the numbers, but we're happy to make sure these technical changes get made and presented to the committee.
When might you be able to get that to us?
Today, this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, commissioners, on this, the A31 amendment, would you make sure that you provide us with the issues you have with this language at the same time?
Yes, Senator Perry.
Any other questions from the committee? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to address us relative to the federal offset program language? Okay, if not, we will set this aside temporarily until we hear more specifically from the department, and then we'll come back to this issue later. The next language to be reviewed is on page R53, related to the salary freeze. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, you've already discussed this concept some this morning, but Mr. Bodden and I can point out some of the differences here between the House and the Senate positions on the salary freeze. You'll notice on the Senate side of R53, line 34, the sentence beginning on line 34.29 and continuing on for several lines, the Senate provides that for purposes of the salary freeze, salary or wage does not include employer contributions for medical or dental insurance premiums, provided that the employee contributions are not decreased. The House does not mention insurance on its side at all, and I think that is likely, my interpretation would be that the House freeze as written applies to salary and wages and is silent on insurance, so it would not necessarily freeze or increase or lower or have any effect on insurance. The other major substantive difference, Mr. Chair, is one that you discussed earlier this morning on the House side. It begins on 50.19. The sentence, the House first defines what a state employee is, which is by reference to employees as defined in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 43A. That includes employees in all three branches of state government, but then excludes faculty or administrators in the Minnesota state colleges and university systems. My language summary mistakenly said that this excludes all of MNSCU. It does not. It excludes only faculty or administrators in the MNSCU system. And Mr. Chair, I would ask Mr. Bodden if he sees other differences we should point out.
Mr. Bodden?
Mr. Chairman, again, Mr. Shepard has covered everything I had in mind.
Questions, comments from the committee? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get the House perspective on the exclusion of MNSCU. I do see the state employee salary settlement formula or percentages here, and it appears that they have not increased dramatically, but I want to hear the reasoning from the House side.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. Well, I sat on the Higher Education Committee and I've seen the commitment that both systems are going to have to make in terms of trimming their budget, and see that if we're not careful, we're going to be hitting the MNSCU system a couple times here. We're not going to be the university system. That would be one. I do see from the history on the wage settlements that MNSCU has done a good job of managing costs, and the representatives of the faculty and administration have borne quite a bit of that efficiency gain. And through their testimony in higher education, I've been convinced that they've been on a track to do much of what we've already asked them for some time in reductions of staff. So I would want us to be careful in applying the same policy to them in an organization that has already demonstrated the ability to look at the efficiencies that are needed to bring their costs down.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that my comment to that is that appears to be correct. Looking at this biennium increase across all agencies, theirs is virtually flat, where the other ones are not.
Yeah, Senator Gazelle, I would concur with that, and I think there's also the issue of treating MNSCU in the same way we, the University of Minnesota. Of course, we can't legislate anything there with regard to theirs. And I think I don't have a comparable sheet of what their settlements have been, but it seems to me we ought to be consistent across the board here with regard to Minsky. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just one final comment or piece of perspective on the Minsky discussion. You know, they have a shared service office, and I know it's the object of a lot of scrutiny, and there was an Office of the Legislative Auditor review done to determine whether or not the universities had properly centralized and standardized in this shared service center the right kinds of functions. And there were a couple of tweaks that they recommended in terms of maybe things that should be managed better at the central office or maybe even distributed. But overall, a lot of the things we're proposing here in terms of centralizing and sharing core IT functions, a lot of those back office administrative functions, I think the Minsky system has done a pretty good job. I'm sure there's plenty of room for improvement, but they've done a nice job with many of the initiatives that we're proposing here for the executive branch agencies already. So, again, just to reinforce the comment about the House position on Minsky.
Further question from committee? We have an amendment to a clarification that I want to get on the table here and have Mr. Shepherd speak to that. It's an amendment, proposed amendment to the House language here. Mr. Shepherd, do you want to explain?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment that is being distributed now would it amends both sides of the bill, whichever version that the conferees decide to adopt, identically, and states that the salary freeze language in this section supersedes Minnesota Statute Section 179A.20. Subdivision 6 or other law that might otherwise be construed to authorize an increase prohibited by this section. The 179A.20 Subdivision 6 provides that after a contract expires and before the right to strike matures and for additional time, if the parties agree, the terms of an existing contract remain in effect. And so this amendment would clarify or provide that existing contract might remain in effect, but it can't provide for a salary increase after July 1 of this year.
Any questions about that? And this would apply to either House or Senate language?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I would move the amendment then. It still leaves open the question of which language we... Any discussion about that? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm not following right here where it says on page 50, line 27. I take it it's 42.27, correct, that we insert the language section C?
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a little bit confusing because I inserted the language on both the House and Senate side, but if you look on page R53 and working on the House side, then it would be on page 50 after line 27, and it's exactly on the same place on the same page on the Senate side, parallel to it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Everybody clear on that? All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard to this section of language? Mr. Stanton. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, again, Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is State University faculty. No surprise, we don't like salary freezes. We think that they're kind of a cumbersome way to try to control costs. They prevent things like equity adjustments. They prevent things like early retirement incentives, which have been very successful for us in terms of saving costs, et cetera. Since it's in both bills, I'm sure you're going to have a salary freeze. That being said, we do prefer the House language, which excludes the Minsky faculty and administrators. Reasons, first of all, when they created Minsky, shortly after they created it, they amended the PELRA law so that the faculty no longer negotiated with the Department of Employee Relations, which is now part of MMB. Instead, they negotiated straight with the Minsky board. And that's an important part of the management authority of the Minsky board. Probably 70 to 80% of their costs are compensation related. So obviously if they're going to manage the system, managing the compensation is a pretty important part of that. As was pointed out, we did negotiate we're first union in the nation, public employee union, to settle our contract 2 years ago when everything was melting down. And we settled for basically just carrying the contract forward for 2 years. And if you actually look at the Minsky units, the total compensation this biennium that was paid out was less than last biennium. And our tails are very, very small. And I would even point out that sheet was prepared before we had a flat increase in the healthcare cost this past year. And so actually those costs would be a little bit smaller. I think Minsky has been very proactive in trying to control their costs and so forth. But we do have some real competitiveness issues, too, that we're going to have to address. Every year, the AAUP's Academe magazine, the March-April issue, does a comparison of the salaries of faculty all across the nation. It's a very efficient market. You can see how you compare it to everybody else. Our salaries are well below average at every single rank for comparable institutions across the nation. We're particularly far behind now dealing with the private colleges, and we recruit nationwide, and so it's very important that we have competitive salaries. We do have a very a big bubble of faculty that are, the cutting edge of it is starting to reach retirement age. We're going to have a lot of turnover. One of the things that we've tried to negotiate in our contract was to at least take care of the entry level, the assistant, where most people are hired, so that we can be competitive in that range. But, those new entry people, the first year they don't get a pay increase, and then they've had a 2-year freeze, and if they go another 2 years, they're going to be reaching tenure time and have to make a decision whether they want to make their career at these institutions, and it's going to be important that they see some light at the end of the tunnel, that some advancement. So we would very much support the House language to take Minsky out. If that isn't the case, I think that there's a better way to do a salary freeze than what you're proposing, and that is to control the dollar amount instead of steps and cost of living adjustments and lump sums and so forth, because then it still leaves, you control how much is being spent, but it still leaves the flexibility for negotiations to take place and for management and the unions to work out something that's in the best interest of both. It's just a lot less micromanaging. So that's just a suggestion, but our first preference, of course, is to get Minsky out, and if that's the case, I don't have a dog in the fight anymore. So thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might just add that in the Higher Education Committee, that both systems take about a $205 million cut. And in the university's case, there isn't a cap or a freeze. And this is an additional burden upon the Minsky system that we don't exact. Now, by statute, we can't do that, and that's a big part of why Minsky is, the University of Minnesota is not added in that. But I think that we do indeed take this into consideration with the size of the cut, and if we were to exact a salary freeze, the only way that they would be able to is to reduce significantly reduce the number of positions. So, additional comment.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this section? Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I appreciate the committee's interest in the competitiveness and for the state colleges and universities. It's about 19,000 employees there, about 33,000 employees for the executive branch. And so certainly that is part of the workforce issue that we're talking about before. In terms of being able to manage costs in the last few rounds, I just want to point out that the current contracts are 0 and 0. In 2004 and 5, there was the same level of increase. And the process is pretty clear, that the process is for the executive branch to negotiate those contracts and that the legislature either ratifies them or doesn't ratify them. And by it's a process point here. By putting this into the language and into the committee final report, you are certainly changing around that process, and I would say in a an objectionable way. The intent of the legislature by reducing the appropriations, by reducing operating budgets, is pretty clear. And I would just point out that historically that has been the case. As to the amendment specifically, I would just, I'm not a lawyer and my state labor negotiator isn't here, but I think it would be useful for staff to just clarify whether this is intended to impact existing contract language as well. And I believe that is a point that at least you should investigate whether you're trying to amend existing contracts as well.
Mr. Shepard, do you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think, and this is for you and the other conferees to state your intent, but my understanding is that this would prohibit any salary increases after July 1, 2011, period. And so if there were any existing contract that would otherwise continue in effect after that date that would provide an increase under the bill as now amended, that increase would not occur.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, so as I understand it, the intent is to supersede any existing contract language that was previously in place.
Commissioner, what in terms of contract expiration, most of them expire, right, or all of them expire anyway, July 1?
Yeah. And again, Mr. Chair, I will happily get more expertise in the room when we can follow up with you. But my understanding is the contracts also discuss what happens at the expiration and what happens next. And so it's not just a matter of state law, it's also a matter of contract.
Well, here's what I'm going to suggest we do with this section. We've got some language that's identical. We've got a few lines in the Senate version that I think are better, a couple in the House that are better. And what I would suggest is we ask our counsel to try to come up with an amendment here that would take the best from each set of language, and so that we could later consider that. And Commissioner, when we do that, it would be helpful then to have someone from your staff speak to us about the implications of this proposed amendment for after July 1. And so we're clear about what, if any, implications there might be. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner Showalter, I do have a question. You talked about 0% increases, and yet, I see AFSCME Council 5 on this sheet here shows a 2.1% per year increase. Minnesota Nurses Association has a 2.47% increase per year. And I want you to clarify for us and maybe for the public what a freeze means and why we see these increases.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent question. The freeze is actually sort of a broad term, and actually can mean a couple of different things, but there's several different elements to the state compensation package that includes what I was referring to is the across-the-board increase. It's basically written in so that all portions of the compensation and classification system get an increase. In addition, there's something known as a STEP, which is a performance-based element that is tied to the extent that the employee is not at the top of their classification. And then there are also other compensation factors, FICA, insurance, things like that, and pension costs, which also drive the overall compensation package. So all three of those factors are ultimately the state, are parts of the state costs, and then, you know, also the sharing of what costs go to the employee.
Senator Gazelka.
Follow up, and that's part of the reason why when we talk about a freeze, we really mean a freeze, and when it's a 0-0, it really isn't completely a freeze. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I have heard a freeze is a not a particularly well-defined term, and I've heard it used in a number of different ways, but certainly that is one way to define a freeze. It's just absolute compensation limitation.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe as part of this next step that we have before us as a committee, we could also think about the language where we do define, I think, pretty precisely what we mean by a freeze. And maybe if there are some holes in that, we would want to tighten that language up. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask the commissioner, and Mr. Stanton made mention of this as well, that from his perspective, a freeze is a little bit of a blunt instrument. And I'm wondering what the alternatives would be. And I think here's my intent. I don't want to speak for the committee. And I think the original bill, at least in the House, was Representative McNamara's bill, and he's not here. So I don't want to overrepresent our position. But me personally, I look at the 2010 workforce report, and I see, you know, labor costs having gone up 4%, 7%, 4%, and 1% over the last 4 years. And so, and I can't remember the total number, $2.4 billion in total wages and compensation in the executive branch agencies. Would we be better off just telling you, okay, you can spend $2 billion however you want, save the state $300 million, $400 million, and give you the flexibility to structure all of this stuff? Would that be a preferable option? And that may not be our intent, because then all of a sudden we could position you for a big springboard on the back end that I think we're trying to control here too with some of our language. But anyway, do you have this comment that a wage freeze is a little bit of a blunt instrument, opinions or suggestions to that side of it as well?
Commissioner?
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate a recognition that a wage freeze is a blunt instrument. Certainly, you know, when the previous administration negotiated contracts and made trade-offs between insurance and wages, certainly other collective bargaining processes have that, because it's more than just the economic factors. There's terms of work. There's many other factors that are involved. And so my suggestion would be to continue using the process that's been there for collective bargaining so that the executive branch and the governor has had and would continue to have the responsibility of assessing the terms of the contracts, because they are complex. Some of the units that you talked about also in terms of increases, Senator Gazelka mentioned, you know, those aren't even part of the major contracts. Some of those are subject to arbitration and other terms that weren't even negotiated out. So my quick answer to a very interesting but very broad question is the current process is a way to try to very specifically work out those issues.
Representative Downey.
Well, just a comment, we can move on, but it seems to me that the current process has kind of landed us where we are, and I think the intent of the legislature is to constrain that a bit so that we at least have some cost controls and can reposition ourselves for structural soundness going forward. So maybe we could have an offline discussion about the merits of just saying $2 billion in total wages and compensation, no more, and you guys do what you want. If that seems equally blunt, but maybe provides a little more flexibility for you. But I don't want to suggest that as an amendment, but maybe just a discussion topic offline before we meet again to deal with this whole salary freeze section.
We're going to have to recess here momentarily. Did you wish to speak to the salary freeze issue?
My name is Kevin Lindsay, for the record. I am the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. On the issue of the salary freeze as it relates to the specific for the Department of Human Rights, we're looking at a cut from the House of 65% and from the Senate of 50%. And then in addition, we would be talking about a salary freeze scenario. That would limit the flexibility of the department to be able to successfully manage in that environment going forward. We would therefore ask the committee that the same treatment which was afforded to Minsky be given to consideration to any agency in which the budget is being cut in some other bill in a comparable fashion. As to Representative Downey's question about the flexibility, I think it's probably a better starting point giving targets as it relates to where the legislature would like to achieve balance as opposed to specific actions.
Thank you. Ms. Boyle?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Julie Boyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. The process that you're talking about here is a collective bargaining process, and we would oppose the wage freeze or any prescription to rewrite our health care into state statute. The process has worked very well in the state, and we believe that it should continue to be allowed to work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pyle. Members, just what I was thinking here with regard to this section, if you look at Senate language 3424 through 3429 and House 5012 through 5017, I think they're identical. And then starting line 29 in the Senate through line 32, I think that language in the Senate has some advantages, and as opposed to comparable in the House. And then, of course, the section on the House language starting 5019 through 5021 is the Minsky exclusion that we've included in the House. And then the remainder of this section is identical. So what I was suggesting is if we could ask our counsel to draft this up in one. It's always difficult moving back and forth, trying to understand what we're doing. So if you're in agreement, we could ask them to prepare that and bring it back to us. Any questions about that? Yeah, and the amendment that we also talked about earlier. Okay, Senator Perry, I understand that you're going into session, and given other meetings that you folks have and that we have, that probably the earliest we can reconvene this session would be at 7:30 or later, depending on Representative Downey and I have Ways and Means at 6 o'clock. I don't know how long that might go. What's that? Okay. So, Senator Perry, if it's all right, if we could say that we will reconvene at 7:30 here in this room, I understand is reserved. And that would be the earliest, would be 7:30. It could be a little later if we get delayed. Does that sound agreeable?
That's fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
One other thing.
Senator Perry.
One other thing, Mr. Chairman. It would be my intent to try to find time tomorrow morning to reconvene. And they're working on that time, but as early as possible.
Okay. With that, we are in recess until at least 7:30.